It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about a place where you can experience true dark, a festival dedicated to stargazing with no distracting human-made lights, the Jasper Dark Sky Festival, which kicks off today.
First, the Government Accountability Board is an independent, nonpartisan government agency, so it's likely to upset both parties. In a sense, that's its job, according to a group of Wisconsin political scientists in a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel opinion piece.
Last week, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss called for the ousting of the head of that board, along with an overhaul. But four University of Wisconsin political scientists responded to that call by defending the GAB.
Barry Burden joins us now. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison and co-author of that piece. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi there.
Well, you say, along with your co-authors in this piece, that far from overhauling the Government Accountability Board, we should consider it a Wisconsin idea that we should be proud of. Now, it has come under fire recently from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, from Democrats in the past. So why do you say this is something we should actually be proud of?
Well, you know, people who live in Wisconsin may not realize it, but elections are run very differently in Wisconsin than in just about every other state. In most states, the central authority in charge of elections is a partisan elected official, often a secretary of state, sometimes an elections board of some kind that is effectively run by the party that controls government. And so you have tangled up in those states what you would hope would be nonpartisan, competent administration of elections with party politics, because the person's name is on the ballot, they're associated with a party, and they're also in charge of running elections. In contrast, Wisconsin has established this independent professional board that is supposed to be, and we think is, insulated from party politics.
Now, to go back to the board's creation back in 2007, how did it come into being?
Well, it's really the successor to something known as the State Elections Board, which had been in place for decades, and was also something of an independent entity, although both parties had some control over the membership. But there were some concerns in the mid-2000s about some campaign fundraising scandals that were going on in the Capitol and other things. And so there was an effort in the legislature to redesign the agency to make it more independent and give it a little more authority when it comes to investigating ethics and campaign finance. And that proposal sailed through the legislature. Almost every member of the legislature voted for the GAB the way it exists now, and Governor Doyle signed it into law. So it's been now, 6 or 7 years in existence.
Now, we make the case, and you've been saying that this is a board that is independent. Can you tell us a little bit about how it functions, how its members are chosen?
So the board itself is made of 6 members, and they have a rotating membership. There are members coming in and out, one per year, essentially. They are former judges who have been chosen by another pool of judges to be potential nominees, and then selected by the governor and approved by a supermajority of the state Senate. So it's a very complicated, multi-stage process, but the idea is that we're selecting people who have good judgment, who have been on the bench, who are separate from party politics, and who have bipartisan support, because they're going to need to be supported by the governor and by 2/3 of the state Senate. And so that's who makes up the membership. And today, most of those members have been appointed by Governor Walker since he's been in office for the last 3.5 years or so.
Now, in the piece, you write that many of the legislators who voted for the Government Accountability Board creation are now beating up on their own creation because it's become inconvenient. What do you mean by inconvenient?
Well, you know, the staff at the Government Accountability Board make recommendations about how to implement various policies, how to make administrative decisions. Those recommendations have to be approved by the board itself, by those retired judges. Some of those are going to be things that irritate people who are in partisan politics. They're not going to like the way a ballot is designed. They're not going to like the way an investigation is happening. They're not going to like the way signatures are being reviewed on petitions, which candidates make the ballot, which don't, all of those things that an agency has to decide on a daily basis. But we think that's a good thing, that party politicians ought to be unhappy with the agency from time to time. That's a sign of its independence, not a sign that the party in control ought to go in and change it for their convenience.
Now, right now, it's the Republican Party, notably Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who's upset with the Government Accountability Board. But it hasn't always been the Republican Party. It's been Democrats in the past as well. Can you run us through a brief history of the complaints against the GAB over the years?
Sure. I mean, the Republican complaints have been more notable, and they've been in the news a bit more recently, but Democrats have had their share of gripes as well. Most recently, there were some complaints that the GAB was moving ahead with implementation of voter ID when it wasn't necessarily required to by the court. There were complaints from Democrats back in 2012 when the recall elections were being scheduled that they had allowed these so-called fake Democrats to run in the Democratic primary. There were complaints years before that that allegations of ethics violations by some Republican state senators were being dismissed by the GAB. So there have been complaints from both the left and the right over the years.
Now, do you think that any of these complaints, maybe starting with the most recent, have been legitimate and should be looked at, or do you consider these as things that are politically motivated and maybe come with the territory?
It's going to be a little bit of both. I mean, there are always degrees of reasonableness when making decisions. I personally would put more trust in an independent professional staff that has expertise in these matters than elected partisan politicians. But, you know, the legislature has the right to change the law. If they're unhappy with, say, the way the John Doe investigations have proceeded or the way ballots are designed, they can get in there and do the hard work of writing legislation, which I think is preferable to tinkering with the agency itself.
How likely do you think it is that this time around any of these criticisms will result in changes to the Government Accountability Board?
Well, Assembly Speaker Voss has essentially promised to do just that. And there's a lot of discontent among Republican legislators with decisions coming out of the GAB. So I suspect there will be some bills floating in the legislature next year. And it'll depend on who's the governor and what else is on the table, whether the budget or other things end up dominating legislative time, but I think there'll be some effort to, if not do away with, at least modify how the GAB operates.
Why did you and your colleagues feel motivated to speak out about this so strongly at this point in time?
You know, when I'm at a conference in another state or I'm talking to election officials or lawyers or other people who are in this field, Wisconsin is held out as a real model of nonpartisan election administration. It's something we think the state ought to be proud of. That's unique and really ought to be a model for what other states should do. And so to see it come under attack and maybe revert to a system that's more partisan or less independent, I think would be a real shame.
Now, even independent organizations, nonpartisan, they're not foolproof. There can be problems that are legitimate and need to be addressed. Do you see that as something which may be true in the case of the GAB?
You know, again, there may be individual issues that need some legislation to deal with them more directly. I think the campaign finance laws are moving fast enough and the court decisions are coming rapidly enough that there may be some interest in modifying those, and that's a task the legislature should take on. But honestly, I think there are bigger fish to fry when it comes to improving elections in Wisconsin. If the legislature really wanted to improve the system, I personally would focus on something like redistricting reform rather than tinkering with the GAB.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Good talking with you.
We've been speaking with Barry Burton, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He wrote an opinion piece along with three other UW political scientists defending the Government Accountability Board after Assembly Speaker Robin Voss called for its overhaul. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Some people may feel a sense of sadness that the nights are getting longer, it gets dark earlier. Others see this as an opportunity to spend more time looking at the stars.
One of the best places to stargaze is in Jasper National Park in Western Alberta, Canada, an official dark sky preserve. Every year they hold the Jasper Dark Sky Festival, which starts tonight. Here to give us a preview of what's happening this year is Brian Attree. He's the Director of Business Development for Tourism Jasper. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
So it sounds like in 2011, the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada officially made Jasper National Park a dark sky preserve. What does that mean exactly?
They've given us the responsibility to protect and promote the nocturnal environment and the clarity of our dark skies. We are trying to support and encourage public understanding of how important this natural wonder is and how people need to look up at the stars and say, wow, this is amazing, it's clear, there's not man-made light or any haze from pollution. So it's quite a nice designation, and we are actually the second largest in the world, but we like to claim we're the largest in the world because you can actually get to us.
Now, we hear about a lot of different types of environmental protection, but how does this work? What kind of specific things do you do there to protect the night sky?
Well, because we are in a federal national park, Development is extremely limited, and so at that given point, by being in a national park, there isn't any factories, there isn't any pulp mills, we don't have refineries, commercial buildings are limited, and even housing is limited. So whenever you want to develop in a national park, you have to go through permitting, and again, if you have to build, you have to cut down a tree, and if you're in a national park, you don't cut down a tree.
Now, unfortunately, Rob and I are not going to be able to make the journey to Alberta this year to take part in the festival. So if we were there, what would it feel like to stand there at night and look up at the sky?
Oh, I date myself sometimes and say it's just like when you were a kid, so I'm not going to do that. But if you think back to the 80s, and again, I think I just dated myself, when you could go outside and look up when you were in town and just see the Milky Way, and for people that can understand, what was it like to look at the Milky Way when you were in town? And now if you go to any town or city, you don't get to see the Milky Way. And for here, I can drive 4 minutes from my house, step out of the car and look up. And if it's a clear night, I see the entire Milky Way.
I'm a little bit jealous, I got to say. Now, this is the fourth year of this Jasper Dark Sky Festival. What kind of new ways do you have to appreciate the darkness this year?
Well, what we've done this year, we've extended the festival to 10 days, and in the past it used to be one weekend. And so what we've done is we've anchored it on two different weekends, and by bringing some businesses on board to promote the dark skies and promote being outside in October, because it can get a little chilly, and, you know, we're up here with the metric system, but I'll translate that this morning when I was going to work, it was 25, and that's not 25
Fahrenheit.
Celsius, yeah, 25 Fahrenheit. And moving into the day today, we're looking at about 40, but it's clear skies, blue skies. And this weekend, we've had Brewster, one of the big tour operators in Alberta, put on the Dark Sky Glaciers and Stargazing Tour. And what they've done is that they are taking people out at night now to the Athabasca Glacier, and you're going to do a glacier adventure out onto it with the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, and there will be telescopes set up, and people are able to be on the glacier looking up at the clear skies, and then they'll come back and they'll go for dinner, and then they'll go to the brand new Brewster Glacier Skywalk and have another session of astronomers there with you. And then moving to tomorrow night, the Fairmont Jasper Park Lodge, they have brought on the Edmonton Symphony Orchestra into town, and they'll be having the symphony outside under the stars.
Wow.
So
dress
warm, but nothing like listening to classical music in crisp, clear skies. You don't even need a light.
Well, you must need some kind of lighting, right? For safety, to see where you're going and footing. How do you light just the path for people's feet?
Red lighting is what keeps your eyes adjusted to the dark. So we use LED tube lighting. You can even use just little LED lights in a mason jar with some red cellophane over top of it. A flashlight, put some red over top of that as well. You can get around, but anything with white light, absolutely bad for your eyes, and then you lose your night vision.
Now, I've been foiled a couple times hoping to see stars by Lake Superior and then realizing I'm up there with a full moon. And the moon's lovely, but it means you can't see those stars. You're blinded by the moon. Do you schedule this to include some moonless nights?
We schedule it around a little bit from that. And one part of the aspect of the moon and eclipses and whatnot, we're actually very lucky to have the festival fall this year. On the 23rd, we're going to have a partial solar eclipse in the middle of the afternoon. Coming up for this Dark Sky Festival, we will be lucky that we won't have a full moon blinding you out. But that's another aspect, actually, of being in a dark sky preserve. I've been outside with a full moon. It's beautiful, and you can see all the stars still.
Next Friday you have an event. It's called Beyond the Stars. What's that?
Beyond the Stars is a no-charge fee. It's adding on to the festival. It's been one of our signature programs, and we will have activities set up out at Lake Annette, and that's deeper into the forest, so to speak, around Lake Annette. And in the field at Lake Annette, we'll have that low-level red lighting and the LED plastic tube lighting, and we will have First Nations and Aboriginal content telling stories of their heritage amongst the stars. We'll have Parks Canada interpreters running heritage programs. We'll have Parks Canada and guest photographers night photography lessons. We'll also have TELUS World of Science Edmonton running some science demonstrations, and some of our guest speakers will be doing some armchair pop culture topics in the stars. One of them will be doing Hollywood Across the Stars. So you're moving around from station to station at a very large field, and Then you'll have the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada from Edmonton. There will be about 30 of them with their Deep Star telescope set up, and you can drop in and look up.
And you'll have one of the most famous scientific Canadians there, I understand, who has covered David Bowie in orbit, Colonel Chris Hatfield. What's he going to be doing at the event?
Absolutely. So on October 25th, we have our evening of space and music, and Colonel Chris Hatfield will be giving his keynote presentation. But we've also brought Jay Ingram, who is the former host of the Daily Planet on the Discovery Channel, opening the show. And Jay's brought along his scientific band with him, so he'll be moving his way through pop culture and stories of science. And then Chris Hatfield will string a tune with Jay and his band a few times. And Chris will be telling about his time up in space in command of the International Space Station, and if we have been good enough and we've impressed him enough, maybe he will even string the space oddity for us at the end.
Nice. Well, you described a bit for us what it's like to look up and see the entire Milky Way. I'm curious about how people react. I'm sure this draws huge numbers of people, and children among them. What do people say?
Wow. That is pretty much people. There are some people that get very emotional. They remember what it used to be like, and then they start to see the impact of man and the impact of oil and the impact of pollution, the impact of everything on the Earth. And, you know, at the end of the day, people are driving here to get here, and we are going to do what we need to do. But by having these national parks in place, it just reminds people the importance of having national parks and these dark sky preserves so you can still come and see it, that it's not going to disappear.
And do you hear people who have been to this saying, we need to do something at home to make it a little darker and make our sky maybe not, you know, as star-rich as it's going to be there, but, you know, appreciate the night sky a little more?
Yeah, I think the first step, what people like to do, is look at what kind of light bulbs they're using in their house and that impact from there. I think at the end of the day, everybody realized the way the society is going and culture, we're never going to be able to get rid of it, but it's your impact, your footprint on it that you can just lessen a little bit.
Do you think it is that important? It's more than just coming out to Jasper to see the night sky, that people should actively be working toward preserving darkness around the world.
I think so, absolutely, and this is the first step that people will realize it, because I'm not from Jasper. I've moved to Jasper in the last year, and I come from British Columbia, and I came from a place where I thought environment was huge, and it is, and lived in a city and then moved out to Jasper, and I even looked at it and went, wow, okay, there is impact going on, and what can we do to diminish it? And by just being able to come to a dark sky preserve or a national park and enjoy the night sky, it makes you reflect a little bit.
It is a dark sky preserve. Is it the dark sky preserve? Are there others?
Yes, there is. So I would encourage your viewers or yourself to go online and just Google dark sky preserves around the world, and there is a large number of them. Another one is Wood Buffalo in Alberta. That's the largest in the world, but kind of hard to get to. But with us, we're the second largest in the world, but they are giving the status to other national parks or provincial parks or state parks around the world. There is a big movement in the United States for dark sky preserves as well.
We could have, you know, people going out there now to enjoy all the things going on at this festival, but if someone just comes during an off time of year when there isn't the festival, is it just as majestic?
Yes, and where it does come into play, we say that we try to highlight it in October because the nights are longer, it gets darker a lot faster, and we're able to promote it and we're able to focus on it. But if you came here in the middle of July, you're just going to have to wait till about 1 o'clock in the morning for it to get dark.
And Brian, I've got to ask, what's your favorite part of the Dark Sky Preserve and the Dark Sky Festival?
I really like the Beyond the Stars at Lake Annette. It's a real festival-like atmosphere. It shows great partnership between Parks Canada, First Nations and Aboriginal groups, our group at Tourism Jasper, businesses in town, TELUS World of Science Edmonton. It's a wide scope of people getting together to put on programming and really enjoy yourself.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Brian Attree. He's Director of Business Development for Tourism Jasper. He was with us to talk about the Jasper Dark Sky Festival, which starts tonight. I would love, maybe this is a bucket list thing for me. I don't know. You?
Well, it's hard not to want to look at a dark sky on a glacier.
Yeah, right? What's wrong with that?
It sounds incredible, I have to admit it.
I always think, like, you know, thinking about how ancient Greek sailors would have looked up at the sky, or the Incas or Mayans would have looked up and seen all these stars. I want to get that view sometime. It sounds like a great time.
I'm Veronica Rickers.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
It's time for Food Friday. Lori Skelton is with us, as she is every month. Today we're talking about homemade pizza. For the last few weeks, Lori has been experimenting with some new recipes, and she's here to share her findings with us.
She's been making different kinds of what's known as grandma pizza. According to Bon Appetit magazine, this is the most reliably delicious pizza you can make for yourself at home. It comes with a thick, crunchy crust. Lori Skelton joins us now. She's been cooking up a pizza storm this week at Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much, Lori.
I counted. It was six pizzas in 2 weeks.
Yeah. That's... And I think I had every one.
And when you consider that up until this time, I've never made a pizza from scratch. I've had pizza from scratch at other people's houses where somebody will make the crust and then you just put on the toppings you want. I've never made a pizza because,
wow.
I mean, it's one of those things I always thought, why bother? Whether it's the next door pub in Lake Geneva or Pizza Man in Milwaukee, you want good pizza, you go out for it or you have it brought in. And so I got the issue of Bon Appetit magazine with this gorgeous looking pizza on the cover. And grandma pizza was what they were talking about. I'd never heard of it, but it sounded so intriguing, I just had to try it.
So what is grandma pizza? How is it different than other pizza?
Okay. Unlike a thick Sicilian deep dish pie, which is baked in a pan that can sometimes be 3 inches high, you've got a crust that you don't roll out, that you don't toss. You actually pat it into the pan with a lot of olive oil underneath it. You want minimal toppings. One of the things that I've discovered about this is it's a Long Island pizza, and that's just starting to make its way into the rest of the country. And in Long Island, it was always the Italian kids saying, make the pizza that Mama made for us back in the old country. It's sometimes referred to as pizza alla casalinga, or housewife pizza. You want it to be simple. Cheese is expensive, so you put on a little bit of cheese, not too much. In Italy, you don't even make sauce. You just chop tomatoes straight from the garden, throw that on, chop up some garlic, throw on some olive oil, and then hot, hot, hot oven. A lot of olive oil under the crust, hot oven. You don't have a pizza oven, but you want to get some heat going. You get a really crunchy bottom to the crust. The crust will rise a bit and be soft and pillowy. The toppings will not crush it. So that's your basic grandma pizza. It's not big, thick wad of dough like certain deep dish pizzas. It doesn't have quite the heft of a Sicilian pizza, but it's also not that cracker thin crispy crust that you get with an 800-degree oven and a pizza peel.
Yeah, it seems to be largely about the crust. Don't get me wrong, your toppings were delicious.
Oh, yeah.
The sauce was amazing, but I think we have to focus in on the crust because that's, to me, what really made this pizza, and it had this crunch when you took a bite.
Absolutely.
Let me interject to emphasize this point. I would have happily eaten the crust without any toppings or cheese.
Well.
Okay, now proceed.
Okay. While I was putting this together, I got a fair amount of my ingredients from Fraboni's here in Madison, and one day Steve Fraboni happened to hear me talking about this, and when you spread out your dough in the pan, you're putting it on half a cup of olive oil and then cranking your oven up to 525 degrees. And Steve said, you know, you're basically frying that pizza. And that's what you get right on the bottom, lovely, crispy, crunchy, crunchy crust. I pulled the first one out of the oven and thought, oh, no, my friends are going to think I burned this because it was brown, brown, brown on the bottom with this lovely little soft pillow on top of it. I brought it in expecting to apologize all afternoon. That pizza was gone in no time, and everybody said it was amazing. So you'd think a half a cup of olive oil, you're going to be coming out with this hot, greasy mess. The crust absorbs all that oil, but you don't taste anything that feels like it's dripping down your chin.
So it's not exactly health food pizza, though, right, when you add the oil?
Well, it's olive oil. No, it's
olive oil. It's a health food.
It's not like you're using lard.
But there's no Fry Daddy involved.
No, there's no Fry Daddy involved. The pizza comes out of the oven, and yes, the oil at the very edges is bubbling as though you were using a Fry Daddy. But after that, pizza sits on the counter for 5 minutes. The oil is absorbed into the crust, makes it nice and crispy and crunchy. You can lift this thing out of the pan. It doesn't stick. It's so easy to work with. And it sounds crazy when you first read it, but as I discovered, it's a real crowd pleaser.
Now, for our kitchen atmosphere, this sounds like it could be a bit smoky.
Okay. If you have not cleaned your oven recently, if you crank your oven up to its maximum temperature, yes, you are going to have some ventilation issues. I noticed as I kept making these pizzas, my kitchen got less and less smoky, so I'm assuming that some of whatever was in my oven got burned off. But yeah, you do need a hood for this, or you need to be able to open the windows in your kitchen, and then don't tell your landlord that you've just turned off the smoke alarm.
Now, you tried some different versions, a 24-hour rise, and then you did one that was half the rising time. What were the results like?
This particular recipe from the Bon Appetit magazine had a crust that needs to sit in the refrigerator, cold rise or cold ferment, if you will, for a day. And the person who put this recipe together for Bon Appetit, his name is Frank Pinello, and he works at a place called Best Pizza in Brooklyn, so he should know. He commented that you really need to get a good flavor balance between minimal toppings and this great crust. So the cold rise in the fridge, he says, is going to give it the great nutty flavor, the great texture, the great chew to it. And yes, everybody was loving the crust, but I thought, you know, not everybody knows they're going to want pizza a day before they have pizza. Can I use rapid rise yeast and just whip it up a couple of hours ahead of time? Now, I saw on our Facebook page today that somebody had posted, here's what my dad used to do for the 9 kids. He'd unthaw frozen bread dough and use that as the base for his crust. The day that I used the rapid rise crust, which spent less than 3 hours rising before I baked it, everybody said, you know, Lori, it's good. It's not as good as the other one. Everybody said it tastes doughy or bready. I'm not saying you can't do it, especially if you just decide I'm really jonesing for a pizza right now. But you are going to sacrifice some of the texture and definitely a lot of the taste if you don't give it the 24 hours in the fridge. I did try a gluten-free version of this because I do know there are some people that can't tolerate gluten, and more Italian companies are noticing that. I actually found a gluten-free pizza focaccia flour mix at Glorioso's Market in Milwaukee. Again, it was tasty. The people who don't normally get to eat pizza were throwing their arms around me and calling me wonderful names, but it still wasn't grandma pizza. I think if you're going to go gluten-free, your best bet these days is to find a good crust recipe and roll that one out thin. I don't think gluten-free can handle grandma.
Hmm. Well, we're talking crust here. Let's talk gear a little bit. We can do this in home oven without the, as you said, 800-degree pizza oven.
Right.
How about a pan? What are we looking for there?
You want what is known in the restaurant business as a half-sheet pan or a heavy jelly roll pan. You want For the recipe that I'm dealing with, you're talking 18 inches by 13 inches and about an inch and a half high. You don't want it so deep like a Sicilian pan because that is actually going to keep some steam in on the pizza. It's going to make that crust not so crisp and a little bit doughier in the middle. But you want a heavy-duty pan. Because if you are cranking your oven up to 525 degrees and you're using a flimsy pan, it's going to warp or buckle in the oven, which means you're going to have all of your toppings all over the floor of your oven and you're going to have one ruined pan. So if you if you don't have a heavy-duty pan, find someone who does or go out and get one before you try making this.
We got to now talk about the sauce, which was one of the best pizza sauces I've ever had, and I'm going to definitely try to replicate it at home. What went into the sauce that you used? And is there anything distinctly grandma about the sauce?
Well, back to how we do it in Italy when mama is making the pizza. You go out to the garden, you grab a couple of tomatoes, you chop them up, you throw them on the pizza. What Frank Pinello suggested, since you are having a crust that has a great deal of depth and complexity to it, since you are using a lot of olive oil, you're going to want to have an actual sauce that has some depth to it. So get a can, 28-ounce can of whole peeled Italian tomatoes, and drain off the tomato puree that's in it. You want these fairly dry. Throw that in your food processor with garlic, more olive oil, basil. I used the last of my garden basil in putting these pizzas together, so that was really cool. Basil, garlic, salt and pepper. You blitz it in the food processor for maybe 10 seconds. You want it still a little bit chunky. And here's the really cool thing. The cheese goes on first in a grandma pizza. And the sauce is spooned on, not spread on. So you've got clumps of sauce on this pizza. And I used anchovy paste instead of anchovies. I know this. Frank Pinello calls for anchovies for the umami factor. Since this is an uncooked sauce, you want to give it a little bit of complexity in addition to the acidity of those uncooked tomatoes. I know not everybody likes anchovies, so I tend to use anchovy paste when I'm cooking. There are some out there that don't have a lot of additives that really do taste like the fish. The other reason I don't use real anchovies, whole anchovies, is I have cats. I open a tin of anchovies, I'm in trouble. I will never get the cats out from underfoot. So anchovy paste, it doesn't have the smell that scares people, and it's a milder taste, but it still delivers the umami. So there's how you get your uncooked grandma sauce. And you're absolutely right that everybody commented on the sauce, that it was a real winner.
We're talking to Lori Skelton about homemade pizza making, specifically a style called Grandma Pizza.
And you can join our conversation. What kind of pizza do you make at home? Are you intrigued by this notion of Grandma Pizza? Sound familiar? Maybe something that you've cooked in your own home, in your own family? What makes it special? And what is your favorite pizza recipe? You can call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page where you'll also find pictures and recipes for this pizza.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Lori Skelton about homemade grandma pizza now.
And you can join the conversation. Have you ever eaten this kind of pizza, this grandma pizza? Have you ever made it at home? What was it like? What kind of pizza is your favorite to make? What's your favorite combination of toppings? And do you have questions? Maybe Lori can give us some advice along the way. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. Nick is joining us from Madison. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Good, thanks.
Fantastic show. I absolutely love this. I've never made the grandma pizza before, but now I'm certainly going to try.
I heard that a lot in the last 2 weeks.
I tell you what, I'm doing a kitchen remodel right now, so I'm completely without an oven, but I'm not letting that stop me from making my pizzas. I've taken to making my pizzas on my grill.
Hmm. I'd be very interested to see if grandma would work. I think you can get your grill that hot.
I use a 5-burner gas grill, and when I have all burners on high, that thing gets hot.
Okay.
And I use a pizza stone for the majority of the pizzas that I've made instead of the deeper dish, but I do have a larger cast iron skillet.
Okay.
That I'd be willing to put on there.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. So, yeah, that makes me think some people grill the pizza right on the grill, the stone. For this, though, you've got to have the oil contained at the
bottom.
You do.
For this much oil, you need to have a pan. Now, if he's using a cast iron pan, he's probably going to get close, although you may be getting closer into Sicilian pie if you're using a cast iron pan. I mean, isn't that how Pizzeria Uno in Chicago got its start, with a cast iron pan?
And those are, what, a couple inches deep or something like that?
I think at least 3 inches deep. So it's a great start, Nick. Let us know what happens. Please post pictures.
Or bring it by.
Definitely.
Better yet. All right, we're going to go next to Amanda in Mequon. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. I am loving this show so much. I just had to call in because I was listening, and I was astonished because you're describing my grandma's pizza recipe.
Okay. How did your grandma top it?
So my grandma's actually Irish, but her husband, my grandfather, was from Tuscany.
Ooh.
So his relatives came over and taught her how to make it. And it was a basic crust recipe, olive oil and garlic in the pan, and then crust. And then, yes, the meat, we would press Italian sausage into the dough, and then we would put cheese on it and then spoon tomatoes on top of the cheese, just like you described.
Wow.
And the pan for us is like a religious thing in our family because my grandparents owned a tavern in Beloit for years, and we still have the tavern pizza pans, and we still use them.
Which tavern in Beloit?
It was called Dominic's. This was in, like, the late 70s.
Yep.
Really?
I went to school in Beloit from 82 to 86. Let's just put it this way. I never ate at Dominic's, but I certainly heard about it.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I still use the tavern pans.
Oh,
my
good
mom and
for
I have,
you.
We decided they're just about worn in enough.
That is a legacy. That is so great to hear.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that, Amanda. Let's talk toppings a little more. She mentioned putting a sausage right into the crust. You had a lot of permutations you worked with. What were the biggest hits?
Okay. We did have the basic, which is cheese, tomato sauce, a little bit of crushed red pepper, which was certainly a pleasure for people. After I did that, a lot of people, including Central Times' Chris Molina, said, you know it's boring, but I really like sausage on a pizza. I happen to love, at Lombardino's here in Madison, their hot sausage and broccoli rabe over pasta. So I thought, I wonder if I can recreate that on the pizza. What I did with the broccoli rabe was I chopped it up and tossed that with a little olive oil and lemon so it wouldn't get completely dried out. And then I took Fraboni's hot Italian sausage, just like Lombardino's does, and I took it out of the casing so that it crumbled all over the top. One thing I think that Grandma's Pizza really needs is something that you can chop up small and scatter over the entire surface. I don't think meat balls would actually work very well. That said, I probably should have used more sausage on this particular pizza. It was one that didn't have quite the flavor that some of the others did. I did use soppressata, which is an Italian sausage, similar to pepperoni. I think it has more flavor. If you like pepperoni on a pizza, soppressata on this is so, so good. We tried a combination of ricotta cheese with red pepper and grilled eggplant.
That was delicious.
Okay. Mm. I think my personal favorite was one of the ones from the Bon Appetit magazine with oil-cured olives, more oil again, red onion, and this time provolone mixed in with the mozzarella in addition to the sauce. And I just picked ingredients that I love, and they just happened to go so well on this pizza.
And we'll go back to our callers now. Let's take a call from Steve joining us in Eau Claire, and you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Hey, Steve.
Hey. This is interesting to me. It's been a long time since I thought about it, but when I was in my teenage years in the 60s, I dated a girl whose grandmother was from Sicily, and she didn't speak English, but she cooked. And her pizza had olives in the crust.
Oh.
It sounds very much like your pizza in that it was thick and crisp on the bottom, but she had olives in the crust. And I'm not talking about black California olives. I mean briny European olives.
Okay.
So, is that something you've heard of? And also, you talked about just using frozen bread dough as the crust, and you didn't say if that worked out very well, and I yet have heard your dough recipe, so
okay.
I'll hang on and listen.
I could see where putting olives in the crust would be a variation on what we're doing. Again, with the frozen bread dough, it'll work, but the general consensus around here, and I'd have to agree, is that it just didn't taste as good as the crust that you had rising in the refrigerator for 24 hours. You can use it. It'll be great for kids, but if you're going to go high-end with the grown-ups, yeah, take the extra time and make the pizza that takes a little more time to rise.
And that recipe is on the Central Time Facebook page. I think it'll be easier to check it out there than to say it on the air. But a tip you gave us, Lori, on the mixing of the dough.
You need 4 cups of flour for this particular recipe. Unless you've got Clay Matthews in your kitchen, I really think you need a standing mixer with a dough hook. I honestly don't see, as hefty as this dough can be, I honestly don't see how you can mix it by hand. The Bon Appetit recipe doesn't say that specifically, but that was my go-to. And yeah, the KitchenAid got a lot of work these last 2 weeks.
One of the things that I loved about these pizzas, I'm thinking especially about the last version of it that you made with the olives and
the red onions,
was you served it on this beautiful cutting board. And so when you took your knife and it just crunched, and the presentation was just beautiful. You could really eat with your eyes in that case.
You probably should take it out of the pan. Rob discovered that if you try cutting this with a flimsy knife, it's going to nearly break the knife. It will definitely score your pan, which is never a good idea. So, yeah, go ahead and take it out of the pan and then get a nice big knife or a decent pizza cutter and have at it.
So I think next pledge drive, a raffle for an opportunity. Lori comes over and makes you the pizza. We get Clay Matthews to do the mixing of the dough, right? Or the packer of your choice. I think we got something here.
Only if Mario Batali is making the sopressata.
Okay.
Wow.
All right. At the $1,000 pledge. No. So a last bit of encouragement or advice for people who want to give this a try at home, Lori.
If you've got the basic ingredients, and yeah, there's a few things that you need that not everybody has, but if you do have decent pan, decent ventilation, and a lot of olive oil, this really is worth it. As I said at the start of the segment, I've never made pizza before in my life, and I'm completely a convert. This is so worth the trouble. You can have a lot of fun with it.
Rumor on the water cooler is you're leaving WPR to start a pizza restaurant? True or false?
No, that's not going to happen. First of all, I've got to get through. I've got to make one more presentation for the Milwaukee Symphony before their concert tomorrow night. I actually had pizza people coming up to me after the concert today and asking about pizza recipes. So
second career.
So I'll see if I can combine the music and the food.
Well, Lori, thanks as always.
Thank you.
That's Lori Skelton, one of our in-house foodies here at WPR, regular Food Friday guest with us to talk about Grandma Pizza. Again, we've got a link to the recipe for Grandma Style Pizza Crust on the Central Time Facebook page so you can try us at home and let us know how it goes.
I'm Veronica Vicker.
And I'm Rob Farah. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.